All right, welcome to another episode of the Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
Hey guys, what's up?
I am sorry to say it's our last episode.
It's a final show.
Final show.
Almost.
For multiple reasons.
For multiple reasons.
We originally thought because Bitcoin's dying and almost dead that it would be our final show.
Yeah.
But then Max and I each almost died on the way to the show.
And if we've lost Satoshi, we've lost Max, and we've lost Steve. What am I doing? I'm sitting here like narrating.
It's just DK and Biddy.
How did you almost die, Max?
DK and Biddy are the only ones left. Fortunately, in the suit, we can put the Biddy suit. Just like, pushed nature too hard, swam too cold, scary experience, made it. But good reminder that, you know, the digital realm. I spend too much time in the digital realm. Going analog, you got to be don't fuck with Mother Nature.
Yeah, glad you made it out.
Thank you.
And you had your own.
I biked to work and laid my bike down, but made it here in one piece. I was a little late, so I was pushing it extra hard and bridges, wet wood bridges.
Laid my bike down is kind of a gentle way.
Is it destroyed? Is your bike like?
No, it's durable. It's my e-bike.
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
So it's like a 75, it's like a 75 pound bike. It's basically like laying a motorcycle down.
Did you crash while it was electric, man?
Yeah. I mean, it's both. I mean, I'm pedaling, but with the motor. Yeah.
Too much extreme sports. Too many extreme sports.
What? But we won't be here next week because it is Thanksgiving.
That's right.
So we'll be
missing you
do this show and then we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah. So we're just kidding.
It'll probably be
actually all over.
It'll probably be a slow week next weekend.
It'll be slow. Yeah.
Thanksgiving.
Remember we used to, when we started this, are we a year in?
Yeah. It was roughly, that's
about
right.
This time last year?
It was November-ish or early December.
And we were going to start a gratitude practice.
Well, that's right. Yeah, we had the Pierre Rochard thing.
Pierre Rochard, we gave gratitude.
We're still grateful for Pierre.
We're still grateful for Pierre, but we have not kept up on our gratitude practice. But it's Thanksgiving, so maybe we can think about what we're thankful for and get back either right now, real time, if you have one, or we can get back in December with our gratitude.
Let's put you on the spot. What are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for you, Max.
That's very sweet.
And
thank
Steve,
you.
I'm grateful for you.
Yeah, grateful for both you guys, too.
Grateful for Satoshi. Since I'm wearing that, sporting that. But yeah, I believe this is episode 49. So not bad. Pretty like for 1 year, right? We only missed.
Oh, wow.
We only missed a few weeks.
I didn't even think about that. Wow.
We
still got a couple weeks left.
Yeah.
Assuming we all,
well, I think we started like the last week of November. So in one calendar year, we did 49 to 50, but yeah.
Hit most of them.
Episode 50, we'll have to celebrate.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Pop champagne or something.
All right.
On the show.
Let's do that.
We'll have to wear a Peter Schiff hat or something.
But well, last week was super exciting with all the Bitcoin payment stuff and Square, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And Spiral, you know, we talked last week. Spiral launched some cool stuff last week. Wave 2 came out this morning. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. My team's rocking.
Tell us, yeah.
Yeah.
We're the no scroll apps guys.
Well, analog. I think as I mentioned last week, I've gone from sort of bear to bull in terms of like coffee payments and retail payments in the US using Bitcoin. But I still think it's going to be a huge grind. It's not like instantly consumers are going to go making payments at US retailers. So we need the Bitcoin army to get out there and help us out and do it in a sustainable way. Right. So we launched a marketing kit last week for folks. Today we announced several different ways people can get involved. And often people ask me, like, they're like, hey, I'm not a protocol dev. How can I contribute to Bitcoin? Well, mm-hmm. I think this is a great way for anyone to contribute. If you're passionate about Bitcoin, that's all you need mm-hmm. is passion for Bitcoin, and you can help in this way. So one, get out there, go to your local merchants, use the marketing kit Spiral's created to help you out. They're just extra tools. That's one way you can do it. Two, if you want to be like a local champion for your city or region, you can now, one thing we announced today is you can apply and we'll send you a box of itty bitty plushies and other supplies.
Your mileage may vary, but for some people.
For you. Well, the enthusiasm has been very high for the plushie. In fact, Joe from Pink Owl told me that kids are stealing it from...
Seriously?
Yeah, oh, wow.
Because he puts it in front of his register and they keep taking it.
Yeah, that's good. All right.
Um, But you know, we started with 5 physical hubs in the U.S. We talked about that last week. Then Kansas City came a calling, so we supply Kansas City. And already today, we've had Rhode Island requests, Seattle, asked Austin Bach. Is he listening? He usually listens.
Yeah,
he applied as well. So we'll get you going, Austin. Austin Bach, not Austin the City. We already got Austin the City covered.
How does someone apply if they want to?
We'll check the Spiral Twitter account. We got the details there, but you just fill out a very simple form. So there's that. Also, we announced contributions to this community. This is not just a Spiral thing. It's public good. So if you want to contribute, we provided some resources today to contribute. Another thing
did that contribute, like you have something, like, is it monetary contribution or
no,
energy?
Like there's a GitHub for the,
or marketing text?
I guess there's software for the website, but it's mainly, this is more of a marketing thing. So mm-hmm. if you want to like improve the one pager, create a new one pager,
translate.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And so that was one of the explicit call out to this translation.
That's cool. Yeah.
And then we're also working on, so we have the marketing kit for Bitcoiners, but we're also working on a marketing kit for merchants. Because once they turn it on, then they realize, oh, not a lot, other than like a few rabid Bitcoiners, normal customers are not even aware to pay in Bitcoin. So we're creating a marketing kit for merchants to help them create awareness and provide incentives. So people who want to contribute to that, we don't have all the ideas and knowledge, so we'd love to have other Bitcoiners contribute. And then another thing we've noticed, all 3 of us have seen several people here at Presidio Bitcoin and throughout the U.S. and even world are really enjoying going out and trying to convert merchants.
Yeah.
Right. And they have stories to tell.
Yeah.
And they have like really amazing stories and exciting stories and wins. And they also have some like losses and like learn, you know, lessons. Like,
right.
Like what didn't go well? What didn't land well? Where can we improve? So I was getting those in like DMs and like these private messaging groups and stuff. And I'm like, I love reading all these, but like we want to share that with more people. So, Spiral created a public Discord for Bitcoin advocates that are going around doing this to share their stories, and then for others to learn from them.
Yeah,
and then we're going to point like Square and all the other point of sale software solutions in space to that.
Oh, great!
To that Discord as well, because like, hey, you can learn a lot about your own products and what it's like to onboard as a merchant. So,
super cool.
Lots of good stuff from Spiral today.
I also just want to throw in my whatever 2 sats story. I did last Saturday. I tried to onboard merchants at my farmer's market or one of my farmer's markets. And I think I spoke to 5 or 6 merchants. And my biggest takeaway is I'm going to go back maybe this weekend, maybe next weekend, I don't know, but and bring the orange flyer. Lead behind is critical. Because I think for a lot of people, let's say it was 5. Of those that I talked to, one guy I have a very strong relationship with, or we've been chatting for over a year. Like he's also, let's say, open-minded, like anarcho-curious. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I was just like, hey man, this is a way to like, you know, give the middle finger to the banks and, you know, the...
So you're not leading, like I thought we're talking about leading with the 3%. But
well,
you're sort
I did with everyone, and I used that with him as well. But this guy and I have like we've chatted for over a year. Like I know his
context,
vibe. Yeah, I know his vibe, and so you know, for him being able to say like, you know, you would like to break away from the corporate overlords who may not have your best interest at heart. That resonated a lot, and of course, 3% savings is also great. So he's the one guy that said he would go and read more and learn about it, and I think he might actually. So I'll be interested to see if he followed up on it or not. But I would say that was like my highest likelihood. Of the other ones I talked to, you know, a couple people were curious about the 3% savings, but everyone kind of gave me a weird look. There was another woman who like definitely seemed keen.
Weird look, like they thought you were
like some kind of weird scammer and like, you know, like what is this Bitcoin thing? Like, one guy clearly was excited about the savings and curious, but, you know, just seemed busy. So I think what I would love to do is I'm going to go back, give them the leave behind. I probably wouldn't feel comfortable doing the plushy thing for them, for these particular guys, maybe the chocolate guy, because he's pretty cool. But the leave behind to show them some way that like, you know, it's a real community. I know one thing that you've been debating is how much to tie in, like this is from Square versus not Square. You know, in my experience, I think having something from this company you know and trust, like also is a backer of this thing. Would I feel like lend additional credibility? But you know, everyone's going to have their own experience with that. Yeah, I'm excited to see. Oh, the other thing that I think we should definitely do, maybe it's in the Discord or as people are sharing this, is I think I asked for this last week, but I would love to see videos of, like, you know, show me step by step, how do I turn it on for a merchant? Because I don't know. I've never really played with a Square terminal. I think we have one here, which I should play with. But I could see the chocolate guy being like, cool, do it for me now. And I don't know how to. So I think that's something, if we get those videos of just like, here's a 2 minute step, that'll help at least people like me.
Is that easy enough to do without? Because I think you were mentioning there's some KYB or some private material that might get shared, some sensitive information. Is that possible to make a video like that? It's just like an ad hoc.
Well, I don't know about how, if there is, I don't know if there's personal information in there, but then someone could go that like has, you know, some basic video editing skills and just like take that out.
Yeah. There's a comment from Deanna saying that, you know, GitHub can be overwhelming. And I just say that for people that haven't used GitHub before, I think that's understandable, but it can be really easy. Like if you're going to do complex, like Git commands, that is definitely complicated. Right. But if all you want to do is express an idea, it's actually quite simple. You can just create a new issue. So you just go to the issues page, click a button like create new issue, and then you type some text. So, I mean, it's literally no harder than an email. Now, if you want to actually contribute and open a PR, there's a little bit more things you need to learn. But since this is content, you're not having to write code or anything. So it shouldn't be that hard to learn how to create a PR for like a text edition.
If we sort of take somebody who's not familiar with GitHub, let's maybe talk through some of what, because you're very familiar with GitHub, so you're sort of talking about it as an expert user. But my understanding is this is a unique URL that effectively hosts something like a blog. The GitHub entry is mostly the text of the thing. And when you say create an issue, an issue hangs out in a public area around that text for other people who are looking at that text to be able to see and review and comment on, right?
Yeah. I mean, an issue is like, hey, there's, I found a problem, or there, I could improve the wording, or or it can be like, here's an entirely new one pager that I created. An issue could be like, here's an entirely new one pager I would like to see created. Mm-hmm. Like the focus on the 3% is great, but I want to create a one pager that focuses on no chargebacks I want a heavily orange pill,
right?
You know, go hard on Bitcoin, whatever it is you want to create. And then you could create an issue which says, here's what I imagine it looking like. And you might create that because you're going to follow up with a quote PR pull request, which creates it, or you're hoping someone else in the community does.
So two thoughts. One, Matt is in the chat. What's up, Matt? And he's saying, our design templates in Canva, no GitHub required. I would maybe just like push all of you guys, particularly Steve and Matt, y'all are so technically literate that like, I would just, one thing that I'm learning over and over and over again, as I'm seeing things diffuse technology, is like, literally assume that like we're working with people who, when you say GitHub, that just terrifies
them.
So one solution that I would like to see, and maybe someone that is technically literate that wants to help, this would be a great initiative for someone to launch, is just do a Google Doc. Everyone knows Google Docs. And then if they want to take that Google Doc and move it over to the GitHub, someone who's more comfortable with that, that would be a great service. But my guess is you'll see an order of magnitude, at least more participation with a Google Doc.
But let's agree to a point, but let me be clear. So no one is suggesting that like merchants start using GitHub. And even the Bitcoin army that we're suggesting goes out and like tries to convert merchants. No one has to use GitHub. The only people that has to use GitHub is the small set of people who want to contribute to like the website and add one pagers. It'll be a relatively small group. I do agree with the point. Even for that set of people,
I saw the answer to magic.
You know, using a Google Doc to start formulating ideas, but the reason why GitHub's important is because this is a public community for open source, right, where people can view what is being proposed, can review it, give feedback, because ultimately it'll need to get merged.
Totally
right. And so like if Deanna wants to create a new one pager, like she absolutely should feel compelled to do that. But it needs to go through a public review process before getting getting merged.
So what I'm saying is I think we can do both, because like Deanna's comment here even says, even when you say or could be confusing, I only know it's pull requests. I've been hoping, I need to get my new context. I've been hanging out around still, LOL. My point is like, I still think it's at least one order of magnitude more people in the army that are going to be scared of GitHub. And this is an opportunity for someone that, you know, there could be like a decentralized version of this where someone does their own, like Deanna, you could just do a Google Doc, publish it. And then I'm sure someone like Matthew saying no need for an idea, someone that's comfortable with both could go and like cull and like kind of aggregate the best ideas. But I'm just guessing it's at least one, maybe even two orders of magnitude more people that will do it if it's just like Google. Just my two cents.
Okay. But then how will they get the public review process, right?
Well, I'm saying you could still move that. I think you could have both,
Who will move it, though? I mean, I guess my advice to people is like...
Matt, I don't know.
Well, that's it. So, I mean, I think if you want to contribute through by reviewing stuff or adding things, you got to get comfortable at GitHub. I don't think it's that... If you're in that boat that you actually want to contribute that way, it's not that difficult to use GitHub, especially for text.
Maybe. I don't know. I would just say like one thing I just keep learning over and over, the last one that hits me in the head is like the bar for anyone to do anything has to be so much lower than I thought. So it's a fair point, but I think there's an opportunity for someone to onboard, like at least I will guess an order of magnitude more contributors if the bar is zero.
Okay. But also I'm going to keep pushing because like we don't want like 10,000 people contributing to GitHub. That would be like overwhelming.
Yeah, totally.
We want 10,000 people globally in the Bitcoin army going out to their cities and converting merchants. That's where we want 10,000 people.
Another thing,
a healthy metric, just having like, frankly, half a dozen people contributing on GitHub is really all that's needed. We just don't want it to be like only a couple people from Spiral.
Totally. And I guess what I would say is maybe there's an opportunity for an agent or someone like a Matt or someone that's like comfortable with both to go and like find, like, I'm just saying there's probably a gem of an idea that will emerge in a Google Doc, and someone who is committed and comfortable in both languages can then come and like move those things over. But,
is Max saying this because he's never submitted a PR?
Actually, have, believe it or not. Believe it or not, I took Justin Moon's Biddle Bootcamp back in the day. So I have, in fact, built Bitcoin from scratch in Python.
I just love the trolling, though.
It's a good troll. But it is true.
You do have a GitHub account?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Check me out, baby. Cypher better. It's been a minute. But I will say, like, I just like that one technology lesson I just keep being whacked in the head with over and over again is like, and we'll talk more about this with defaults, like however simple you think something is, it's got to be 10,000x more.
Maybe what we really need is like a Google Docs-like interface
for GitHub. Ooh, that's
built on Nostr that actually, you know, can use the commenting interface, but it's actually, you know, simplifying the UX to make it feel more accessible or normal.
Another even easier way to do this was imagine if you have a bot that could just go through Discord and like super easy. It's like, hey, if you have never touched GitHub, you don't want to, you just like post your stuff in GitHub and then the bot could just go and like get the best ideas, publish those, and then someone, you know, from Spiral or wherever could just like, oh, like this is cool. This is worth adding or not. So anyways.
Cool. Anything else on this topic or we
I think it's on? Awesome. Like I'm also like Steve, converted from skeptic to like pretty hopeful.
Yeah. Speaking of Spiral and Square and Block, there was this, I think it was a big earnings call. Was it last week or a few days ago?
The earnings call was a few weeks ago, but this was a Block Investor Day.
Okay, Investor Day.
Earnings calls are obviously every quarter. This was the first Investor Day. And I think three and a half years or so.
Like the last one
was during the COVID era, which kind of sucked. I mean, everything about that era sucked, right? But I mean, it was remote, videotaped. I participated in that one. I felt super robotic. It was the first time I've actually read off a teleprompter when being recorded.
And that sucks.
I didn't think I really. It turned me into being very robotic.
Right.
So I would need I would need to practice more off a teleprompter. Basically, I don't like teleprompters.
Who does?
I like to just shoot from the hip.
Yeah.
Like. So anyway, but this one was, you know, in person, is here in the Bay Area, and I was here this week at like the HRF event and stuff, but I didn't attend. But by all accounts that I've heard, it was a really, you know, really good day, vibrant. You know, the great dynamic being in person. I think there's a lot better story to tell today than 3 years ago about the company. So, yeah. And I think, you know, the people, the executives that did tell the story had a lot of good things to say.
Yeah. And the video is going to be out. Is that, I looked and I didn't see it up yet. Is
yeah,
it?
I looked yesterday morning's last time I looked and it still wasn't available. So I don't know the ETA, but.
Well, so I think the summary most of us read was by our good homie Q Baby. Shout out to Q Baby. There's like 19 or so points. Oh, what did you guys think from?
Because I only know his Twitter account, but apparently, I mean, he was there in person, so he gave an in person account.
So we can verify he is a human, though.
Well, I can't.
He's a cute baby giraffe.
Yeah,
but
as a toddler now. Toddler. Okay.
It's suggesting that he's a real person.
But I thought it was interesting.
There has been speculation. It's like Miles Suter or Jack, or I think it's actually an independent person from Block.
Right.
Interesting.
From Block meaning somebody who works there.
Independent from Block.
Yeah.
Like not a Block employee.
Part of Block.
Someone who's invested money in Block. Cares about the
armchair
shareholder value.
Kind of.
But it is interesting because he's like obsessed with Block. And I've been following this dude for a while. Like he's got some good, really good ideas, good alpha, but like whoever it is, like they're
His analysis and commentary is, you know, generally quite bullish and optimistic, which is consistent with investing in the company. He seems to really get what we're doing with overall, but including Bitcoin. And I think maybe one of the things you wanted to bring up is like a lot of other investors, at least the way QBaby reported, like at the investor day, that when Bitcoin was brought up, there was, you know, less of an appreciation.
Everybody's kind
for
of rolling
it.
Their eyes, like, about Bitcoin again.
Yeah.
This is 2025. What is going on?
But less of an appreciation for, well, I mean, I would guess such investors would definitely roll their eyes at what we're talking about with like Bitcoin payments to retail, which that specific thing about Bitcoin,
even
most Bitcoiners would maybe roll their eyes at that. Even I was saying 2 months ago, I kind of rolled my eyes at like buying an American buying a coffee with Bitcoin, because to me that was like the last use case that I could imagine being converted. As I've talked about in the show, my mind's changed on that. But overall, it still surprises me that overall a company doing great things around Bitcoin, it not resonating with a lot of the investors. It's kind of surprising.
And as an investor, your job is to find things that the market doesn't yet believe.
Well,
if the whole market believes and knows a thing, it's kind of too late. It's already priced in. So you have to be, like as an investor, your job is to find opportunity where nobody else is looking or noticing.
I mean, you're talking about the platonic ideal of an investor, right? Sadly, in a broken market with broken money, it feels like more and more investors are just playing it safe. Like, look, I mean, people spend more time thinking about what the Fed is going to do than actually trying to find a gem. So I wish what you were saying was true, but I mean, Cute Baby seems to be one of the real investors out there. So shout out that guy.
So my point, though, and I think this is what Steve is raising, because we talked about this a little bit yesterday, is I think, you know, we come at this from like Bitcoin holders who care about the principles of self-sovereignty and self-custody and, you know, scarcity. And you know, there's a lot of those kinds of things, and those don't resonate with a merchant when you're pitching it to a merchant. But we've kind of discovered, or through, you know, the work that Spiral's done, that 3%, save 3% is the message. It's not down with the state. It's not self-custody. It's save 3%. Every merchant probably perks up at that.
For sure. Who wouldn't?
And so my question is, why is there not similar messaging to help explain to a candidate investor in Square, kind of like disregard the Bitcoin-ness of it? Like, that's not the story. The story is make, you know, these, there's this monopoly of, you know, the Visa controls.
Duopoly.
And you know, Bitcoin enables you to not be subject to the behest of that monopoly.
Well, can we have real talk? I mean, to me, the big question I have, and, you know, Steve, you can shut me up and kick me off the chair at any point if I need to, but like, to me, like, it's very obvious. It's like, just disrupted Visa with this. Like, Bitcoin, 3% fees. I mean, who's not going to use that? And so to me, as an investor, if I'm looking and saying, wait a second, So in the old world, I had to use one of the two players in the duopoly, Visa or MasterCard. They're charging 3% fees because they have a duopoly. And then someone else is coming and saying, we're not going to charge you fees. And like, obviously you can't do that forever. Like Block has to make money at some point, whatever, 1% fees, you still radically undercut them. Like I'm looking at this and I'm like, if I have two brain cells as an investor, I'm like, well, Visa is one of the most profitable companies on the planet. And these guys just undercut them. Seems like a big deal.
Yeah. And what, so I haven't watched Investor Day yet because I wasn't there and the video is not available yet. But I'd have to think that the cutting out the fees was part of the messaging. So I guess we'll find out when we watch the video.
Well, Cute Baby said, they said a couple of times, this is a paradigm shift or something like that. So
that was the, I think that was in relation to dollars on Lightning,
yeah.
Which is very much related to this. But again, maybe it didn't click yet. I don't know. But I mean, the cutting out the middleman, saving 3% fees, that doesn't take a genius to click.
That's what I'm saying.
Dollars on Lightning and things like that, that's a little bit more. You might need to hear it 2-3 times or different frame, different ways to really rock that. And then let's see, Ram asked, how do employees at Block feel about Bitcoin? I can comment on that. I mean, I joined the company over 6 years ago. And when I joined, there were like 30 people. There's like a Slack channel called Bitcoin, right? There's probably one like that at every company. And there's like 30 people in that when I joined. So, I mean, when I joined, the company had already launched buying and selling Bitcoin on Cash App. And
yeah.
I mean, the company was already like very much known for, at least within the Bitcoin community, known for being into Bitcoin, right? And Jack was already very public. And vocal, the reason I even joined is because they created Spiral. So they're all the
Square Crypto.
Oh, yeah. Square Crypto.
Square Crypto at the time.
Square Solana.
So, I mean, there are already all these like public data points on like, oh, Block's about Bitcoin. But I joined, there's like 30 people in this like, you know, many thousand person. Right. I think there are 4,000 employees at the time. And so that Slack channel has grown to well over, it's over, last I checked, 1,300 people. It's probably way more now.
Wow.
So just the level of engagement and interest. Another data point, like back when we worked on that paper together 4 years ago, energy and environment and stuff like that, there was a small but loud negative group on Bitcoin within the company. And I haven't heard, there's even like a Slack channel called, I actually forget what it's called now, but it's the haters. Like the people who hate Bitcoin, they have their own Slack channel.
Why do they work at Block?
Yeah. Well, I mean, some employees have been public on Twitter too, with very aggressive tweets that are negative.
I mean, that would be like me working in JP Morgan and be like, down with banking. Like, I hate banking. Like,
well, but I mean, maybe what Ram is getting at is that if you take almost any big tech company, the majority are not Bitcoiners,
of
not
course.
Into Bitcoin. Right. I would break it down roughly as like, you know, it used to be 1%, now maybe 5% are Bitcoiners, and then like 5% are haters, like just like emotional and truly hate it and go
Matthew public. Says it's hashtag Bitcoin dash sucks. Right, is that real?
Yeah.
No mommies.
It is real. But I don't think it's been active for quite a while.
Oh, Lord.
But I mean, it's sort of like 5% huge advocates, 5% haters, and then 90% sort of like don't care, busy with life or curious or something like that. And I think a similar, so joining Block back then, it was kind of a similar distribution, which I think might surprise outsiders because they're like, because from the outside, it's like, well, the CEO, the founder and CEO is
that's
like
my point.
Enormous advocate. But two things. One, just because a CEO is passionate about something doesn't mean thousands of employees are that they're passionate about something, right? And then also just the way, you know, Jack leads, I mean, he very much allows people to have their own view and perspective. And he's not going to fire you just because you don't like Bitcoin.
I mean, but I guess my point is like I would expect, and maybe I guess just the human nature of like you already have a good job, you don't want to do it. But like if my like founder and CEO came out and started being like, I am so pro Solana or whatever, I would just bounce.
I mean, you literally did that.
All right.
The man walks the walk.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, but the last point I'll say about to answer the question about like Block employees, there's definitely been a noticeable shift over time. The haters, have either left or have been convinced otherwise or are just quiet now. I don't know. But I think like the, you know, the middle 90% employees have definitely shifted towards a better understanding and appreciation. And even if they might not identify as a Bitcoiner, they're much more supportive is my sense. I know that at the Block by Block event in September when 10,000 employees all came to Oakland, there were some human rights activists that came for a panel and spoke how they use Bitcoin, you know, similar to the HRF event that happened this past week. And that really impacted a lot of employees as well. Because you gotta remember, people who don't work in Bitcoin and think about it all day long, like us and a lot of our audience, you primarily hear about Michael Saylor and people getting rich and scams
and shit.
Right? Like that's most the news. So that is your impression
right.
of Bitcoin. How does that picture align with Block's values of economic empowerment, people, you know, giving access, financial access to more people? It sounds like two different worlds.
Yeah.
But then you hear these stories of the human rights activists who have actually used it for real good, that changes minds. And,
sure.
And if we do see success with small businesses able to cut out the fees and thrive, obviously that will land well with Block employees, but beyond Block, like Silicon Valley and everywhere, because then, like, you know, the little guys being helped out then.
Are you suggesting every Block employee has not read The Creature from Jekyll Island yet?
Well, so I'll have to add that to their reading.
Just making sure. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Okay. So should we talk?
Well, I mean, just one more point on that before we jump into whatever the next topic is. Like, to your point, I guess one thing that like has just been very eye-opening to me in the last 5+ years, like getting into quote-unquote investing professionally, like is, you know, I came into this and really thought, like kind of like you thought, I was like, oh, like there's more like efficient market hypothesis. Like people are like truly intellectually curious. They truly want to find truth. And that, I mean, I guess exists, you know, in a couple of corners, but it's just been shocking to me up and down the stack from early stage, especially to like the bigger funds you get later stage. And I get it, human nature, people just want their, you know, their fees and this and that. But like, it's been honestly like a little, I don't know if the word is disheartening. I mean, in one case, it's really encouraging because like I used to look up to a lot of these funds and I'd be like, oh man, like Sequoia does it. I know it's the best. It's like, now I'm like, man, I'm not really sure these guys know what they're talking about at any stage of the fund. I mean, there are very smart people and there are exceptions, but I don't know. It's been very eye-opening to me of like, you know, efficient market hypothesis is absolute bullshit. And just in general, like most investors, I just don't really take seriously based on the whole Bitcoin thing. So,
one last point on the investors, like
I don't know,
investors who maybe, you know, don't get Bitcoin or don't see how to incorporate it into valuing a company like Block. This is just very anecdotal evidence, but I've heard two or three instances already just in the past week of Bitcoin Army going out to merchants saying, hey, you know, you want to save 3%, turn on Bitcoin.
Sure do.
Right. So, and then the Square customer tells them, and this isn't even like a Square employee. This is just like a Bitcoiner. They tell them like, we're about ready to switch to a competitor like Toast or whatever. And then they learn about Square accepting Bitcoin and it actually retains them as a Square customer.
Really?
Yes.
Because of the fees.
Well, saving, I don't know what combination of like saving fees versus like, oh,
curiosity
of Bitcoin or even just like, oh, Square's still like alive and relevant, alive, doing new innovative things. Like it might be reframing the brand as like fresh and doing new exciting things.
Yeah.
Whatever. So I don't know the answer. It's only a few anecdotes, but it, I mean, given the short amount of time and only if you, you know, it might actually become quite significant. Even if the Bitcoin payments don't happen, if it just from a Square perspective, if it like refreshes the brand
totally.
In customers' eyes,
that
alone is great business value.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. And even from the investor community, I think, you know, like, frankly, a big question has always been like, when Jack is locked in, he's a product goat up there with like a Steve Jobs. Question is, you know, is he locked in? It's very clear he's locked in right now. Like you can't look at how quickly the company is shipping. Like literally when I saw, I guess it was last week when like every day Miles is, I don't even know how much that was planned or just like, fuck it, let's just ship it this week. But like literally every day he was like, all right, first you can accept Bitcoin. Then you can do dollars to dollars using the Bitcoin network. Now there's no fees. I was really like, literally is like, is Elon up in here now like doing this? And I don't know. I think a lot of investors, I'll tell you personally for the first time in a long time, I'm thinking, should I be owning Square stock?
Well, I'll tell you, Sequoia led the Series A.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Roloff seems perhaps more locked in than some of the other Stripe crowd there, but whatever. Like,
I do.
That was also like 15 years ago.
I do expect product velocity to continue and keep the
momentum. It sure wasn't Andrew's.
keep the momentum up. So anticipate, you know, because the Square team shipped the. Moved fast to get this out and they hit the deadline. Great. Usually when you do that, there's like a list of things that you know you wanted to get into that release and didn't. So they're going to power through that list. And there's been tons of great feedback received from real world usage. So there's a tons of things to improve. And I think we're going to see over the coming weeks.
No, I love it. And I'll tell you just even from my like with other investor conversations in the sauna, which I do from time to time, there is renewed interest. And I will say to me, this feels like if you came out and told me that like Kawhi Leonard is healthy and back and ready to play a whole season, I'm backing it. That's what it feels like. So let's go.
All right. Quantum. What's up?
I think it's more about the price movement.
So right,
from my vantage point, there's nothing new about Quantum. We put on a huge summit here at Presidio Bitcoin in July. We brought together world experts in quantum physics, in Bitcoin dealing with quantum. And we went through like five different threads of topics. And to me, there's not a whole lot new since then. But other than like, I mean, the price of Bitcoin has dropped 35% or whatever. And people are, you know, speculating why.
Freaking out.
Is it like early investors? Is it quantum risk? Is it I've heard theories about the October 10th. I think it was October 10th when like DeFi blew up or whatever, and a lot of the DeFi people playing, but just all the crypto stuff like blew up. That remember it dropped like substantially one day, or like billions were liquidated on a Friday night or something. Hmm. I don't follow the stuff either, but anyway, like one theory is that a lot of those players got overexposed and they're having to sell a lot of Bitcoin to like to stay afloat. So
I think there's two different conversations here. One conversation is why is the price down? And I do think that's a fair conversation. One possibility is it's quantum risk, which is why we're leading into that. Then there's also just this thing. So just so I understand, so you're basically saying, and I don't know a ton about the DeFi world anymore, but maybe one of these like large liquidity providers or market makers had a bunch of exposure to shitcoins. The shitcoins blew up. They are holding Bitcoin. And so they're being forced to sell the Bitcoin so that they can cover their other positions. I think I saw someone shared a tweet, maybe it was one of you guys, about this like profit dude that was kind of interesting. And he was basically saying that like the way whoever it is.
P-R-O-F-I-T or P-R-O-P-H-E-T.
No, P-R-O-P-H-E-T. Profits over profits, if you know what I'm saying. Interpret that as you will. But that basically then it's like a, like not.
I still don't know the ratio. Is it profit over profit or profit over profit?
It depends on the day. depends on what price we're at. pH, acidic, not base.
Right.
We got have some freestyle.
I like it.
Just give me a little beat, you know. But which reminds me, we got to talk to Matthew about some Bitcoin stuff and music. But basically, this I have no idea if this is true or not. I've done zero research other than read this tweet. But his argument was that it's a like every day there's like a sort of almost programmatic or algorithmic selling happening that's like not at all responsive to what you would expect in markets, which might suggest that someone's like underwater and they're trying to sell in such a way that it doesn't freak everything out at once, not dump at once. But at the same time, it's like very programmatic. I don't know if that's true or not, but maybe. I will say I have been chatting with some friends in the background and like the quantum stuff, certainly not helping that there's FUD about quantum happening at the same time. And I don't even know if FUD is the right word. I would say maybe two things have shifted my own personal concern maybe about quantum since the summit. One is, well, I listened to a good podcast with Preston Pish and Charles Capriol, and this is the energy money guy that I think is pretty sharp, as is Preston. And basically one thing that he said and I know you're less concerned about this, but we can maybe discuss on air, that I hadn't really considered is like, you know, the tricky thing with quantum is it's like the error bars are huge, right? So like he's saying on the short end, 2 years. I know the kind of like consensus that I remember from our summit was 5 years, but whatever. Let's say it's 2 years on one end and never on the other end. So that's like a pretty big range. And, you know, if it were 2 years, the point he was making is there's about a quarter of the coins that are still directly pay to pub key. A quarter of all UTXOs out there, I guess. That's what he was saying. And his point was, if you wanted to move from pub key directly to a new address type, which is quantum resistant, so we think, or so the understanding is that I have, the caveat by all this thing, it's scary when you're not like in the quantum deeply. You're like, well, I'm just kind of taking secondhand, you know, whatever for this. But his point was like, how many years would that take if all of those UTXOs wanted to move and you basically all hit the mempool at the same time? And his argument was, I think he said 2-ish years or like 18 months, press and push back, and was like, actually, it could be many years. I know you're not concerned because it's not a lot of value in a lot of these UTXOs, but that was something I had not thought about.
So I'm not concerned about that specific issue. I'll give a few reasons why. Bitcoin can move several hundred million transactions a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's not that many UTXOs. So,
but he was saying there's a quarter of all UTXOs out there now.
So, I mean, it would take months to move everything, not years.
Okay. I have to go back and see what their math is. There's some discrepancy.
So that's one point. And then, but also, when people give time frames of like 2 years or 10 or 15 or whatever time frame, you know, what you also have to ask, what's happening at that point? What are you know, what's happening at that point in time? So in 2 years, what does that mean? Does that mean there's a cryptograph or a computer that can break
ECDSA,
a key?
Yeah.
Okay. How much does it cost? How long does it take?
Mm-hmm.
You got to ask those questions, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Because if it costs $10 million, So right now it's not even possible. Like there's no computer that exists that can do it, right? So some future milestone will be like, okay, now there's a computer that can do it, but it costs $10 million and takes 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still not that threatening. But it would be, that would be a huge advancement over today, because today no computer even works to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Then, the cost and time will go down over time. But when we say 2 years, what exactly is that? And I say that because most likely at some point there will be a really expensive, slow computer that can do it. But clearly, if it costs $10 million to break a key, you're not going to target a UTXO that's only worth,
right,
you know, $1 million.
You're going to target Satoshi score,
let alone $10 or whatever. So while there's a lot of UTXOs, most have very small amounts of Bitcoin. When we actually look at UTXOs that have their public key exposed, like pay to pub key, the vast majority have 50 Bitcoin because they were mined,
right,
early on.
Okay.
And let's see, what's 50 Bitcoin worth? Something like $5 million, right? So
used to be.
Yeah. What, you know,
you use old math.
$4 million, $5 million.
Before quantum fun.
So if it costs $10 million to break a key, you're not going to do that for one that's only worth $4 or $5 million. And then again, you have to look at how much time. So, and then I think there's only a handful of exposed UTXOs that have a lot more than 50 Bitcoin. So that they can all be...
They can move quickly.
They can move quickly. But to the far more concerning thing...
Is the lost ones.
Is that, yeah, are the ones that can't move because the keys have been lost. So
yeah,
it doesn't matter how long it takes to move. They're not going to move because... That no one is around.
That still doesn't concern me as much personally, although maybe the market's going to freak out. But one thing I would love to see, and my guess is for the investor community, if I had to guess, if I still feel some uneasiness or queasiness about this, my guess is more of the traditional investors feel that on steroids. And so, yes, we did the Quantum Summit, which is awesome. And I should go back and rewatch the videos, as should everyone that's concerned. One thing I would love to see, and maybe this is worth funding for, you know, I don't know, people we know who are interested in making sure the big money is not freaking out. I would love to see an in-depth research report. And I saw Nick Carter also posting about this in a way that he seems concerned. And like, I actually, you know, take Nick's concerns pretty seriously. He's been pretty right on the money about a lot of things, Bitcoin, energy, AI over the years. The fact that he has any concern at all to me is like, okay, I need to go back and do my own research on this, which I will, but very few people are going to do this. I would love to see sort of a Nick-style paper, and maybe this, Nick, if you're listening, this could be great for you or someone else, that just goes through and is like, really has like expert commentary cited, or maybe an expert writes this from like, here's what Google is saying, here's what PsiQuantum is saying, here's what Microsoft is saying, the people from those companies, really breaks it down, explains like I'm five, to your point of like, here are the error bars of what we would reach, here's how long we think it would take, here's what the economic costs are. And then they look at, for each of those scenarios, they kind of do some like scenario planning of like, if it's $10 million in 2 years, if it's $10 million and takes whatever, 12 months to run, here's the coins that are at risk. Here's the total amount of value that is, and here's how long it would take them to move. If it's in 2 years at, you know, $1 million and a week, here's what that would take. Like, I think what's scary is it's just like, for something so foreign to so many people, myself included, I don't know, man. Like, I'm hearing all these scenarios thrown out there, and like, I have no, at this point, even after the summit, I don't feel equipped to truly evaluate what those timelines and what those economic like thresholds look like right now.
Sounds like we need like your energy, anti-energy FUD paper.
We need someone like that. Quantum. Yeah. It's probably not going to be me this time.
Is he in the room with us?
I got a lot on my plate. Maybe. I don't know if I, but like someone that is like, she wants to go like autistically deep on this and then explain it like we're five. I would love that.
But the, another takeaway for me from the summit we did in July is that while there are some real challenging problems if a quantum computer is developed that can crack ECDSA, like we can respond. Meaning there is cryptography that is quantum resistant that Bitcoin can adopt. In fact, there are several options. So right. One of the challenges now is which one to pick. And does it have drawbacks? Yes, it's less efficient. But if you're from a pure investor perspective, mm-hmm. digital gold narrative, it doesn't really matter if you can only cram 1/10 of the transactions in a block than you could before. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's a valid argument to reduce the block size so that fees actually, there's a more healthier fee market. So it has a negative impact on scaling,
sure.
and for other use cases. But if we're truly in this dire situation where Bitcoin literally is going to die or save it for the digital gold narrative, and then, you know, longer term figure out the scaling, obviously you're going to pick the latter. And there's already plenty of options to choose from. And if we're in some, if we're in a situation where we have actually reached a point where a computer can crack a key for $10 million, mm-hmm. obviously we'll have a sense of urgency to upgrade and get it done.
It'll be easy to get
consensus. Consensus.
Well, you
and,
say
and
that.
Then the other...
I hope well, you're
then,
right.
Then there's the topic of, you know, do we burn the coins that can't... that we think can't move, because we don't know whether they can. Yeah. So if we're truly in some panic situation, emergency mode, probably set a window of time, like if your coins don't move in 6 months or whatever, they're going to get frozen. And again,
so I strongly disagree with that. Strongly. So I think all of these are really good points you're making. I think someone needs to write the definitive paper on this and explain
what do you disagree with, though?
That we should freeze any coins. Like, I am very strongly in the free market camp. When they get hacked, that's the bounty. The hacker right. takes them.
I do agree that's
strongly.
That's the most controversial decision, and there will be a split in the community. So I think Bitcoin will split, and then the free market will win. And
well,
your coin will go to zero, and mine will go.
Well, hopefully not. But like, I'm not that OG, bro. I wish, but I think what needs to be laid out as whoever works on this like, you know, anti-energy, anti-quantum FUD paper is like, yeah, lay out all those options and explain the trade-offs of like, yes, we have post-quantum cryptography, but it's fat, which is what you were saying, which means signature size is thicker. With thicker signature size, less scaling. What does that do to Bitcoin? But I think what a lot of people are concerned about, what I'm kind of concerned about is like, you know, the longer the Bitcoin community goes, like this whole ordinals thing or whatever it is, the
knots thing.
The knots is so ridiculous in my mind. And the fact, I mean, I think it's probably just a psyop to get people distracted from actual issues like this. And like, if we're if the core community, the people that are actually making these decisions, are getting bogged down with something so silly, what is it going to be like when we actually have a hair on fire problem? That's my concern.
Well, okay. But most Bitcoin developers would say that the quantum thing is exactly the same thing.
So that doesn't feel like that at all.
It does. That's why we had a summit here. I
attended the whole summit, and I'm not convinced.
I filled my quota this year of quantum. We had the summit.
Now you're like me with the nuts, crap.
We had the summit. I'm really glad we did it. I'm glad I put some energy into it, and other people did as well. And I learned a lot, and I came away like I feel like I don't think it's an imminent threat. And if it develops into an imminent threat in 2 years or 5 years or whatever, I sort of have in my mind, okay, I know exactly what will need to be done. And while there's some thorny thing issues, like it's a lot easier to develop consensus when a key has been cracked.
So what do you think would happen? So I hear you, and yet, even though I was there, I don't share the same degree of confidence. I would like to. I want to get there, which is why I'm asking someone.
What's your concern?
All of the above. Like, I don't understand
We know of quantum-resistant cryptography. It's less efficient.
Right.
But if we're in this, like, extreme existential threat scenario, then who cares? Like,
right. Max, do you believe that we don't have functional quantum computers today that could crack Bitcoin?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Like, today, we don't have the quantum... Do you believe that's true, or you don't?
I don't even know that.
Okay,
probably.
That is tough to...
No, I mean probably right.
It's like just fun. I mean, like,
okay, I'm not saying it's fun or not. What I'm saying is the fact that I have these questions, like this, could be answered in a definitive white paper. No one has published that yet. I would like to see this. Now, to your point, let's take all the different scenario planning, you know, whatever ahead. And I do think you're underrating how much of the concern this is going to be for investors, like.
I never said that. I agree it's a concern.
So
it's just cheaper Bitcoin for us right now.
Well, so. I hope you're right. So my question is, I think the thing you're probably the expert at that you would be able to say almost better than anyone is, not the quantum stuff, someone needs to write that, but a key gets hacked. What happened? And you say it would happen quickly. Like if you had a sort of scenario plan for that, what do you think the community does to get a soft fork together?
Well, the first thing is how do you validate that it was hacked?
Great question.
How was it hacked?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an interesting intellectual exercise. But let's, for the sake of argument, to get to the point I think you're saying, let's say we have proof that a quantum computer did it.
DK's getting sick of it.
So then I think, you know, first thing is like get a better understanding of how much did it cost to do that, and how long did it take? So if it's $10 million in 10 years or something, or, you know, some super long period of time, then, I mean, there'd still be a urgency to make changes, but, you know, it would be a very different story if it was cheaper and happening, happening much faster. But like, what would happen? There'd be, developers would be quadrupling down on like, okay, what are technical options to upgrade, and there'd be a mad sprint to figure out which one to do, get developer consensus on that, write the code, write the tests, get it prepared for a soft fork. And then in parallel, the rest of the community will be like observing that and debating that, et cetera.
That's screaming on Twitter.
That's one thing that would happen. And that one, I guess will it be chaotic and a shit show? Sure. But like, I think the end result will be satisfactory. And I think there will be consensus on, we can get to consensus on that in an emergency situation. Another question, which is definitely the harder one, is what to do with the coins that we don't think are going to move or don't move within a certain window of time. And that's where, you know, there's definitely a community split today. And it's not something that like developers can weigh in on objectively and say like,
no,
this is correct, this is incorrect.
That's a potential.
This is philosophical.
Yeah.
And so it really is something that all of Bitcoin everyone in Bitcoin should be weighing in on. And protocol developers don't have any extra weight in this decision.
Mm-hmm.
Investors certainly whether you like it or not, they definitely have the most weight because that's where they're going to put their money behind where
they want
the right decision.
Yeah.
I do think there's real risk of a fork there. But even if there is, the market will play out and one of them will get chosen. So will that be chaotic? Absolutely. But will Bitcoin die? No.
Yeah.
It just might be that like the, and like, I think you and me, like you're even in our little squabble there, it's like, oh, you want the let them steal. And I'm like, freeze. I actually don't even feel that strongly about it. So yeah. Like if there was a fork, I'd hold for that issue. I would hold both sides of the fork.
Same.
I don't have like this strong conviction that this is right and this is wrong and I'll double down. No, I'm going to hold both.
Yeah.
I bet you would too.
Yeah, probably would.
And a lot of people would. So then like, well, okay, one of them wins. And then like, I just don't care which one wins, to be honest.
Why?
So one of them wins and then great. That's
Bitcoin.
I don't know
that it necessarily is right. There's not like a right. Like when a BCH fork comes, you'd be like, this is trash. Get rid of it.
I think most people that will be indifferent to that decision or like kind of favor this one, but find the other one acceptable. I mean, certainly compared to like Bitcoin's dead.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so a couple thoughts on that. I mean, just on that last issue first, like, yeah, I would probably hold both in the same way that, like, I don't want to, like, lose either way. And, like, that's my top priority as an individual actor. Having said that, I could be convinced to get more involved. And, like, to me, there is a right answer. And the right answer is, like, Bitcoin is free markets. And you either believe in free markets or you don't believe in free markets. And at the end of the day, I sadly think it's very clear to me that there's a line in the sand of, like, you know, you start by saying, with good intentions, we freeze the old coins because it saves Bitcoin. I think that's also very like short-term price-driven. Like, yes, that will probably prevent panic in the market. But at the same time, to me, it's a very slippery slope to Ethereum. Very slippery slope. And like, okay, who, you know, and you know, 6 months, what happens if that person, I don't know, Satoshi happens to be cryogenically frozen and wants to come back and move their coins? To me, it's a non-starter to mess with anything that's not your own. And I just haven't.
Well, I've responded to that, but I just wanted to point out Ian Smith chimed in. I know he's heavily involved with the quantum stuff. And
yeah,
my impression of his perspective is he thinks it's happening sooner than later and that Bitcoin needs to change. So thanks for listening, Ian, and chiming in.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said he's going to prepare a demonstration if he can about a quantum.
You're about to hack Bitcoin, bro.
All right.
Keep in mind there's, you know, one of the things we discussed at the summit is like there's burn versus freeze as well. Meaning that we already know of mechanisms that if I don't move my coins, then they get burnt/frozen. They're actually frozen versus burnt.
Sure.
I mean, no matter what is done, they're frozen because you can always do another consensus change in the future, which unfreezes them.
Yeah.
Right. And so, what would that look like? One thing that I learned this year is that if you have a seed phrase to your coins, that you can prove that your coins and a quantum computer cannot prove that. Mm-hmm. Because a quantum computer cannot go from a private key to the seed words, mm-hmm. right? So interestingly, even though I'm generally a proponent of seedless is safer, here's an example of where having a seed phrase is quite powerful.
Steve just changed his mind.
Everything's about trade-offs. So that is definitely a win for seed phrases.
Kind of intelligent.
So again, like I think with if the coins are frozen, yeah, if Satoshi wakes up or whatever, well, he would still be in trouble because he doesn't have seed phrases for his coins. But for people that have seed phrase, they would, if there's social consensus to introduce that mechanism,
yeah,
then they could get the coins back.
I hear you and all that. I just, to me, it's just, it's a clear bright line. It's
I want to understand like what, so we're talking about whether, you know, the price just dumped 35%. How much of that is due to quantum fear?
Yeah.
So let's put our hats on. All we care about.
You already got yours on.
Yeah. And, well, I've got my Satoshi hat on, so I care about peer-to-peer money. But let's say I have my like Michael Saylor hat on. All I care about is number go up, price go up, digital gold. Let's get rich. Let's say that's all I care about. Then I'm worried about quantum, so I sell my Bitcoin because I don't think I think it's a bad investment. Well, why? I'm still not hearing a reason why. If a computer comes along and can crack the keys, we will change the cryptography to resist that. And there's this difficult philosophical debate about freezing coins versus let them be stolen. But one of the, and there probably will be a split in the community in a fork, but one of them will win out economically.
Yeah.
And so,
so it'll be a shit show, but it'll be a shit show.
But Bitcoin will still exist after that. It'll be secure and it will be unified and
more resilient.
So, and frankly, it'll have survived this horrible attack or whatever.
Sure.
And then
everything's good for Bitcoin eventually.
So everyone's Bitcoin investment thesis remains intact. So why would you sell your Bitcoin?
I think it's a very easy answer, and I can answer in two ways. Number one, I'll talk first like fundamentals and then like sort of timing, right? Fundamentals, like to be clear, the post-quantum cryptography, and again, I would love to see this laid out in a white paper. It's like we say we would make that change and we say that that would be whatever, function secure. But like my understanding is still the post-quantum cryptography is still like, it's not been battle tested for like 50 years. So that's still, it's a different proposition. I hear you. And like, we think it's right. Like we think lattice cryptography or whatever we end up using works, but like, it's not like ECDSA, it's been around forever. So there is new risk with a new algorithm. And like the only way to do that, just like with Bitcoin versus gold, is time in reality. And so it is a different world. Like I would still be generally very favorable toward that and generally like agree with where you're going in the long run, but it's not in my mind, the same slam dunk it is with the old world algorithms. The bigger concern though, is it's not even a concern, but if I'm just an investor and let's say I'm in like the perfect world where I don't have to pay cap gains or like trading, like if I really think that this is going to be a shit show and like, let's say I think Bitcoin could crash 80 to 90% again. Okay, cool. Like I still believe in the long run. I dump now, I buy again when it's at like, you know, whatever, 30K, back to the races.
Yeah. But I think that the first point you made, I think that's a, you know, that's a valid point. I personally would assign it like tiny value.
Sure.
So it doesn't really change. I don't think it changes the investment thesis. Like maybe instead of like, you know, a 10% allocation, I do a 9.5% allocation. Or I mean,
10%.
I can't, just meaning.
Bro, like, what kind of Bitcoin are you?
Yeah, what's going on here? And he means 110%. Don't worry. 109.5.
The second point, though, I don't really agree with. Meaning that like the timing the market argument, because
I'm not saying that's my position. Like
I know, but I've just for any investor out there, I don't find it to be a smart way to go about it because there's so much uncertainty about if and when the quantum computer will even exist, and you know, I obviously don't know when this will happen, but through all the information I've consumed from a broad set of people, to me, it seems like it's still 15 to 20 years away. And even if that's like, even if it's 8 years away, that's just such a long time period to stay out of the market and not accumulate. So, because like, let's say it's 8 years away, which I think is a pretty aggressive estimate still. Mm. Bitcoin, most of us think Bitcoin's going to $1 million or more in 8 years. So if I could buy it today for $80,000 and then it goes to $1 million and then we go through a shit show and it goes crashes down to $300,000 and then after the shit show it goes back to, goes to like $2 million, why wouldn't I not have wanted to invest at $80,000?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is not that you would just do both. Like imagine you're someone who's extremely, extremely, extremely convicted and you're, you know, like Steve, 110%. Now, maybe you reduce your allocation from 110% to 55%. You say, look, whatever, like if it goes still to the moon, like I win either way. But like, maybe does it make sense for me to hedge with a post-quantum resistant rock?
I agree. If you're overexposed, trimming some of the position probably is a smart idea regardless.
And I think that's a question of like, that's what's happening?
And now, you know, and with, you know, yeah, I think that's reasonable. But if you're on the sidelines or what many Bitcoin investors would say underallocated, then I think it makes no sense at all to let quantum scare you out of.
I agree, but I would just say before this one thing, and I still want to get deeper on it, I'm not super concerned yet, but like I'm glad we're having this discussion. Like, frankly, we need to be raising a few more alarm bells if this is, you know, even a 0.1% chance of like breaking our thesis. Like, we should be aware of this. Is the first thing that I've ever been like, okay, I need to like actually learn more to understand, because I think most of us would agree. I mean, the 110% is the correct weighting if you know Bitcoin, but
don't use leverage.
I'm just kidding.
I think coming out of type one or coming out of the quantum summit, I thought that you and I each assessed maybe 5 years felt like our assessment.
5 years was like the clear. That's what I took away from the summit. But also with huge error bars, right? Yeah. Like the Japanese dude was also being like, it could be in two, it could be never.
Yeah. Speaking of Japan, you shared this tweet about maybe one of the other reasons that Bitcoin might be dumping the markets are going to dump, which is some guy was kind of talking about macro stuff around the Japanese carry trade and the end of the carry trade, which kind of fueled financial markets for the last 40 years.
DK is clearly a sophisticated macro investor.
Not at all. But like,
since you raised this, I assume you're going to break it down for us.
Yeah, well, explain us the carry trade, DK.
I thought you shared the tweet with some... something behind it. Was it just like, look at this alarmist on Twitter? Or?
Dude, don't you know? I just share tweets. I don't even read them.
Exactly. That's
what I'm got like an agentic bot.
I understand how he does it. You see something that he just wants to like get us to talk about briefly.
He shared it and I was like, oh shit. Like, is this going to blow up?
I really
tomorrow?
Have nothing to say. Okay. I don't know. I mean, well, I think we all know the high level Japan economic scene from the past 30 years, whatever.
Is unsustainable.
But like the specific concern that the person tweeted about, I just simply am not deep enough to really know.
I mean,
they clearly didn't move the market this morning. Yeah. I mean, the tweet made it sound like
he's like, get ready, well, Armageddon's coming tomorrow morning. I also read that last night. I was like, oh shit, like what's coming tomorrow? And then I woke up.
Clearly, like math is math. So even just looking at the United States, the interest payments on our debt, like, are growing. When interest rates go from 0% to 5%, obviously your interest payment debt goes way up. Since our debt continues to grow, the rates are going up. I mean, Americans are spending over $1 trillion a year of our budget on interest debt now, right? And so,
which, by the way, how insane is that?
Like, so
it almost sounds like you
can simply do the math. And I forget the exact numbers, but if it's like a 10 or 12% rate, I mean, if you go back to like 1980 era, interest rates rose to like 15% or something. So imagine if they did that today, our interest debt would be greater than our entire federal budget. So the math simply doesn't work, right? So the United States cannot handle rates that high. They can't really, I mean, we talked about this a couple of years ago, like the rates cannot go to 10% without things just blowing up. And then ultimately, really the only way out of this, and like Ray Dalio and any other like savvy financial people say, you got to print money. That's the only way out of this. So Japan has been in a similar situation, except for decades.
For a lot longer, yeah.
And so I think this guy tweeted about they are raising their rates now, and it's just going to like blow things up.
They sort of kept them artificially low. Yeah. And people executed this arbitrage across the cheap capital you can get.
They borrow in yen and then invest elsewhere. Yeah.
And because of that, that's actually a reason why it might hurt the price of Bitcoin.
Hey guys, this is unusual, but I have to second week in a row.
We're going to have to.
It's now a habit.
We're going to schedule a doctor's appointment for Max.
He's just a urologist or something.
Or well, since he's, I mean, get him like a old like a boomer diaper or something.
I've heard about this U.S. debt problem forever, and it always seems unsustainable, yet it keeps going. So is there like one moment where people will finally
wake up? That's a great
question. Because it's like,
because I do, I literally,
being a kid,
I remember being
thinking,
a kid.
This is insane.
I remember in the 80s hearing the ballooning debt under Reagan or whatever, and that it was unsustainable. And if you did the math then too, it did seem true. And here we are.
Do we need like something but to I mean, pierce the, you know, prick the balloon and kind of what? Is there one catastrophic moment that may happen?
I mean, if you print money, you can get yourself out of this pickle, but then there's obviously negative ramifications of printing money. So I really think that's, that's what's been done historically. And I think it's just going to continue to happen.
Let me summarize for Max.
Mucho mejor.
He said, nothing stops this train.
I see someone's listening to a Lynn Holland podcast or two. We should ask Lynn. I don't know if Lynn listens to this. If anyone knows Lynn, like, I don't know. I just...
not doing his kegels.
Oh, yeah. No, it's terrible. Like, I do pound... I should probably stop double-fisting tea when I get on the show, but kegels maybe too. Warm the room up. Huh?
I think they're... No, I mean, I think we'll just keep printing money, right?
And so it'll just be kind of the so it'll be kind of just like,
oh, okay. I call this something very important. Steve's told us what's gonna happen.
Yeah,
we were just talking about the Japan thing and how in the 80s, even back in the 80s, we were like, this is insane. How does this exist? And it just keeps going. So,
well, I asked my friend that. My friend's like a sort of macro hedge fund dude. I remember like 10 years ago, I kept asking, I was like, Japan doesn't seem sustainable to me. And he kept being like, well, that's for this reason and cultural and this. And I do buy there's like some cultural, like they can like sort of like diffuse or like inflate away more than most places can. Because I do think Japan has like such like a almost like Japanese hive mind sort of vibe. Like people really do like no one like, like you can drop your credit card there and like everyone will pick it up and find you. Like bathrooms are spick and span. Like they really do have like a more collectivist, I think, culture than most places do, but you can only like do that for so long.
You got to export TVs or something. Like you have to do something that other people value.
Totally.
You can't just pick up cards and be nice, right?
Yeah. I think my takeaway like from this and all of our investing conversations is just like, it's going to be really interesting to see what the world looks like with investing again on like real markets. Like this is your brain on, you know, whatever fiat. And like, it just doesn't make sense because it doesn't make sense. Like it doesn't make sense.
Anything more on price or should we talk about MDK?
Well,
let's definitely get into that. But.
Yeah. One last thing is, you know, a lot of people have a lot of respect for Warren Buffett. I'm not going to say one way or the other, but he has made his career on value investing and saying like, find the things that are underpriced and good assets. And for two decades, Larry and Sergey from Google had been prompting him to participate in Google. And Google really looked up to Warren Buffett and wanted him to get involved.
Why?
From the earliest days of going public. And he finally made an allocation, a big allocation last week.
So, okay, I have a couple questions.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Finally, yeah. It's like 20 years late.
Yeah. I don't know. Even like Warren Buffett, it's like, I don't know, like a lot of these guys just seem like very close to the money printer, like playing rigged games, banks they can't lose. Like, right. I'm not sure I have a lot of respect for him ever. Yeah. But to your point, I mean, I think aren't a lot of people suggesting it wasn't Warren that made that allocation, but like
the
successor.
But also, it's not late in the sense he has such massive amounts of money, he couldn't have invested in some tiny little Google 20 years ago, right? Which is the whole problem of when you get so big, is like getting returns, the same kind of returns that Berkshire did in the 70s and 80s and early 90s is like impossible.
I think the
techniques that he used and got famous for are probably not really available anymore. Like the market moves and changes, so you kind of have to always be adapting.
Kind of like the kind of returns HiveMind is going to return are impossible for a Sequoia or V16Z to do.
Our absolute assets may be small.
It's a big multiples game then, right? Yeah, it is.
It's more fun that way too. Like I know all these guys, they, you know, it's like banks get fat on fiat, investors get fat on management fees.
Good. So that's a great
segue to your investment. Yeah. We all three invested in a new company.
Well, sorry, I just want to add one last thing because I do think it's important. So when I do see them though, I think in the back of my head on this macro point, like Buffett has been in cash for a long time. My other thing is just like, are people smelling? I think it's going to be a very weird economic time because it's like, are people smelling some big crash? You see all this macro stuff. It seems like there's a crash coming. Yet at the same time, we have this like, the investment in AI infrastructure and data centers, I'm quite convinced is just going to go vertical, even if there's a giant crash.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's allocating Google makes me, again, I've been so super impressed with Google the deeper I'm going. But it does feel like we're entering this like completely uncharted territory. Not only, like we've never had a situation where there's been like a fundamental macro crash, but at the same time, like literal new and industrial or agricultural revolution level technology is going to require, you know, presumably like all of global GDP to build out the data centers we need. So it's a very weird time.
It's a weird time.
I don't think anyone fucking knows is the short answer. Like this is like uncharted territory.
The money's going to keep printing. Everything's going to go up. Printing.
Actually, that's another dynamic too. Like if AI ushers in it, like unparalleled prosperity and economic growth or whatever, then that also is a way out of a bad debt situation.
So. It's worth noting. Okay, but much more exciting, and it's not just HiveMind. I hear there are a few other investors here on the podcast with me. We all, I think, are very stoked and excited. It was already announced, but we have invested, each of us, in a company called MDK, Money Development Kit, from our guy, Nick Slaney. Those of you who don't know Nick, I think I met Nick maybe 4 or 5 years ago at a random BitDevs back at DG, Digital Garage. And at the time, I guess he was on the BitKey team at Block. And I was just like, we were chatting about all this like Lightning Network rate of returns, sort of some of Nick Bhatia's early ideas. And I could tell this guy is super, super sharp. Yeah, we had a good lunch and like talked about a lot of these ideas. Like a couple months later, he's like, actually now I'm building this out of Block, which then became C Equals, which has become, I don't know if it's like how you rank it number one or certainly an industry leading node. And all of the big announcement that Square gave us over the summer when we had the Bitcoin conference was they're getting 10%, let's say roughly 9-10% return on capital, however you want to calculate that metric on that Lightning node. Still a small node in absolute terms, but I think it's like $100 million or something. So it's not small in Bitcoin terms, or at least Bitcoin industry terms. And yeah, I think Nick deserves a lot of credit for figuring basically how to build that node. And anyway, so I've been a big fan of his for a long time. And when he left and started playing with a new idea, MDK or Money Development Kit, I was very excited. Someone I've been tracking for 5+ years or 4 or 5 years. And I love his thesis. And I know, DK, you've spent a lot of time with him. But the thing that really I love about MDK is they're trying to find the easiest way to add Lightning Network or Bitcoin payments to a new website or vibe-coded app in like minutes. And so he just launched in his video what he's calling a world record. I don't know who's like arbitrating that, but like whatever, we'll go with it. A world record of the fastest time to add payments to a new app. And it's pretty impressive.
Yep. And I think I believe the positioning is adding payments.
Yes.
Meaning not necessarily, I mean, it is literally adding Bitcoin payments, but like,
yeah,
I think you I think worked with them on that messaging, but just add, you know, the fastest way to add Bitcoin or to add payments.
All right, it's
but really convening with a Stripe UX. So that's what I wanted to, because I've been you know, challenging DK and Nick as well about like, okay, but can't you add payment super fast with some of the other tools that we've been seeing, mm-hmm. like Lexi, yeah. and with a Spark SDK, etc. I think the answer is yes, but we can do a bake off there. But if the answer is not yes, I think all of them, if not already, will soon be able to do less than 5 minutes. So, but we, you know, you shared some other, both Nick and you shared some other ideas about like, how can the positioning of, you know, of this product win? Even in the face of other SDKs that can do that. I don't know if you wanted to elaborate on that.
Yeah. So the details were, I think, you know, the video showed like, oh, hey, like app to payment acceptance in 5 minutes, world record speed run. And then I think Stevie made some comment like, can't you do this with like Spark and Lexi and maybe Stripe or a few others? I haven't actually tried kind of a bake off like that. But I think there's probably like, I don't think you purely can differentiate on like the 5 minute implementation, because now that's kind of possible. Probably everybody can kind of do something of that flavor. But I think there's, you know, if you say we really care about focusing on the developer experience, and developer may be a newly emergent developer, might be a certain type.
The builder, even, not a developer.
Right.
A
vibe coder who can build something that's economically valuable to people, but doesn't have access to Stripe, doesn't know how to do API integrations or SDK integrations much, and kind of wants to vibe code it.
Is asking what a pull request is.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's very real, very real. So I think like we're sort of maybe too deep in GitHub to recognize that newcomers may not be, you know, have a lot of facility with these tools. So I think the developer experience, you know, maybe starts with a 5 minute app to payment acceptance, but I think there's so much more to it. Like, who are you marketing to? Who are you speaking to? How are you speaking to them? How does your documentation work? How does the developer experience is like, when I have a problem and I talk to somebody, do I get an answer from the person building it, or do I get shuttled through some help center? That's developer experience in my mind. So I think the fact that like Nick created a video and shared, and he's obviously accessible and available on Twitter. If you build something with MDK and you have a problem, obviously tag him. And I would bet that he will be very quick to respond. Whereas if you get, you know, it's not like I actually like the fact it was not some high gloss, you know, kind of corporate website. He's speaking as an individual, which is really, you know, I think he should lean into that, what he is today, and be the best at that. Because that's the kind of thing that I think can attract a different type. So he can run hackathons. There's so much to developer experience besides the 5 minutes, but I think the 5 minutes is like kind of table stakes, let's say.
I think both he and you also pointed out, there's the dashboard and tools behind, like,
yep.
tools facing that the vibe coder would use, and that's a product differentiation beyond just the 5-minute onboarding.
Yeah, and I think it's also notable that like we love all these companies. Like we're also investors in Lexi. I'm an investor in Albi. A lot of these companies, like they're, I think it's all Team Bitcoin, Team Lightning. And there's like, sorry, there's so, we're so early. Like, you know, I forgot what I was, hearing about this, but it's just like any, I don't know, like startup competition is not really a thing in my mind. Like there are going to be so many niches to fill. Like the competition is Stripe, to be frank, right? And so I think I'm glad to see Nick has been, at least in my experience so far, unique. I mean, all these guys are exploring vibe coding to some degree, but what got me over the hurdle, I mean, I was already a big fan of Nick. I just think like what he's done is already gangster at Block and he's going to do it again. But what really got me sold on this particular idea, and I think you really helped him on this, was laser focused. Don't focus on Bitcoin. This is payments for vibe coders. And that to me is very compelling.
Yeah. And maybe you could speak more, because you pointed out to me too, just the focus on marketing, like, because I'm like, well, what about Spark? And then you went and looked their positioning and their framing. And it's just, they're trying, LightSpark's trying to solve, you know, work on so many use cases, just like very expansive.
Investor in LightSpark too. Like,
and so, you know, with if a company really singles in on vibe coding, it's just going to reach more people that will never even learn of or discover Spark.
Right. And I think Spark, I looked on your challenge, I looked at the Spark marketing copy for the developer site, and it has really nice, like, here's the code. You can see it right when you open up the site. But it says, like, to build the best, I think, financial applications or, like, asset issuance, which sounds like that itself is a big market, and that presumably is where they see a lot of value and want to focus.
But it's different.
But it seems different than, like the examples, you know, that Nick was sharing with me is, like, you know, if you run a tarot card site, you know, like that may not work for Visa because they, you know, maybe there's some potential fraud or chargeback rates and there's concerns around that. But like if you run that site and it's economically valuable and people want to pay you, how do you accept payments? Like that's not solved, whether it's vibe coded or otherwise.
Well, I think it also just the number of countries, like how many countries is Stripe operational in? It's like less than half, I think.
Right. Yeah.
So like, yes, they have the largest part of the GDP pie. There's still like a huge chunk of humans that can't access it.
And I think there's also not, like, I mean, you remember before Stripe, there was Braintree. You could kind of do the thing, right? But it just wasn't like really well done. And you know, Braintree, I think, still exists and probably was acquired. I don't know.
What are the odds that Nick is now going to get us all into cold water, hot saunas, and trying to get us to eat his figgy pudding soon?
But I think
that's act two.
This market is so big. Like, let me ask you, which is the vibe coding company?
Replit.
But that's not true. It's
Gemini 3.
Well, Claude, I mean, what about Lovable? What about Cursor?
Yeah.
Like, there's just, these are huge. Cursor's worth, what do you think Cursor's market cap is in private markets? But what do you think it is?
$2 billion.
No, 80.
Is it? Okay, I was going to say
Cursor's
30.
Cursor's $80 billion?
Yeah, it's something
they,
in that.
They just raised again.
Are you
Did
serious?
They just raise it 80?
I think it was.
That could be.
I'd heard definitely on the order
30 recently, but it no, certainly
they
could be.
They raised again like months.
All right, later. I'm feeling like Michael Burry right now.
Did you register high mind?
It's a little unfortunate. Founders, you should know, did not get into that company.
Right.
Yeah, because they were there. I remember. Yeah, I saw the picture. Y'all also had, and this one also pains me. I've had some.
Maybe they'll do retroactive or something.
You had Anthropic there too. I also.
Right,
I passed an Anthropic. Yeah. So that they were too woke.
They were
Jesus.
They were pretty small at the time.
Well, that's the kind of companies that go through Founders, you should know.
Yeah.
So, by the way. Odd like in tarot. The series.
You don't like tarot. No, I have no problem with tarot.
I think Visa we're just doesn't surprised. Like tarot.
Yeah.
And therefore, Sprite what? Doesn't like tarot. But
No. But I wanted to get to back
29.3 billion. Thanks, Matt. All right.
Seems
like
a I don't know. Maybe Steve's got some inside intel. This is Silicon Valley insider here.
Dude, I mean, just to be fair, like Square is like a $60 billion company, right?
No.
What is Square now?
Less.
Less
38 billion,
dude. If Cursor is raising its Square valuations,
well, like Circle's worth like way more than Block.
Yeah,
I'm not judging.
I understand.
I wanted to get to someone's comment or question. Yeah. How is the custody handled when it lands in the app? Is that factored, or is this more of a transport and the app handles the storage routing after? So, MDK is based on Lightning Development Kit, which my team created.
Who works on that?
but my understanding of MDK each customer that's using it. So like if I were a Vibe coder using it to handle my payments, I have my own keys and my own node and my own channels. MDK manages that for me, but I'm the only one that has authentication and access to that node and the keys.
So the assets never live in MDK.
I think it is run in the cloud.
Uh-huh. He calls it, and I, coming from not being deep in developer land, serverless, and my question was, well, then where is it running? And apparently what serverless actually means is server, but on demand.
I mean, it's marketing for you don't have to set up.
I'm not saying that's
you don't have to set up your own server. I think that's what the implication there.
Yeah. Right.
The other thing we should talk about are the fees. Cause I saw, one Twitter pundit, saying, oh, you charge 2%. Cause that's like,
oh yeah.
That's like, is it more or is that good or bad or is it more or less? Well, it depends on your frame of reference, right? So if it's compared to Square, which just said 0% until 2027 and then 1% thereafter, well, it's more. Or if you look at...
But Square doesn't have an API, right?
Exactly. That's an apples to oranges comparison.
Why doesn't Square do that?
And that, why
it's
doesn't
like a
Square,
merchant like yeah, POS system.
Why not have an API of online payments?
Yeah. Well, I mean...
Why doesn't Google build a social network?
Yeah.
They try.
I know, right?
And I think Block has tried... I think Block has made a weak attempt in the past at that, but I mean, Stripe is formidable there and,
That's Nick's opportunity.
But
let's
go. Maybe that's a growth opportunity for Block in the future. But in any case, I think if you look at the fees that Stripe and other existing players charge, it's 3-4%. So from that perspective, it's cheaper. So.
And I think a lot of people, there's so many people in the world who can build things who are locked out of that system. That's not like a trivial rounding error. That's like a big part of humanity. So I think even if it were 5%, they might find it valuable compared to the fact they can't get anything from Stripe. Now,
right. It's
healthy competition. Like I think Lexi is a good solution that touches on thematically similar Spark. Touches on some similar theme. So my point of talking about cursor valuation is not to say it's the right one or the wrong one. I'm saying you just said that Replit is the winner of Vibe Coding. I'm saying there's a $30 billion company you didn't think is the winner.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think this is similarly such a gargantuan market that you could have an MDK and a Lexi and a Spark could all independently
be
successful.
They're all going to be big companies. I agree.
In their own right, but they just end up serving different niches. And so,
And I think it's also important to remember, I remember someone making this claim that a decade ago, people all underestimated how big Steve's laughing. I don't know what that means. How big markets are when you expose it to the internet. Basically, I think the TLDR is just the economic pie. Number one is not fixed. Number two, when you expose it to the internet, it's a lot bigger than you think. There's going to be a lot of winners. The fact that Braintree, PayPal, Stripe, Block, all these companies are extremely successful companies. There's a lot of opportunity if we're right on our thesis with Bitcoin. So it's super, super, super early.
So Matt is now throwing down reference links to sources.
He's brought the receipts.
But also it looks like it's dated November 13th.
Oh,
so he's
a week.
That's a week ago. What about their raise
Steve's
days later?
There's another one.
It must be. They're only valued at $29 billion.
Only 29.
So only 29.
Yeah, I was even overestimating it at 30.
Seems like a good deal. although I will say, I think about this. Are we even going to have IDs in the future? The thing I'm much more interested in is what happens. And we should also give a shout out. I guess we don't have a lot of time left, but we had the opportunity to jam with some folks that all Pablo and. We're running out of time, but I have a big topic I want to talk about. Maybe I'll tee it up for the future. Yeah. I mean, so think about the future of software development and thinking about where do we go from here? Pablo's got some interesting ideas. We'll talk about it on a future show. One thing I want to tee up, and maybe we can have a longer conversation next week, because it's very important. We were all at sort of an AI, open sourcey, freedom-y thing. And the one thing that stuck with me that I am a little concerned on was in a conversation with Cody. And Cody, for those of you who don't know, is a Bitcoiner now at REPL. And he made a really good point to me, which is, and actually, Matt, I'm super glad you're listening. This one is to you. I asked him, how bullish are you on making it easier to build with Bitcoin and Nostr and Lightning Network? And his point to me was a bit of an eye opener. And his point was, I don't know how easy it really is to build with like an Auster app and REPL today. I know Matt has done this. And so I would encourage, you know, Matt in particular, you are a great hope here to make sure we don't become irrelevant and die. But his point to me was, if you're using REPLet, and let's assume REPLet, that was our first answer for what is the vibe coding company, right? So a lot of people are using REPLet. And if you try and build a Lightning Network or certainly a Cashew or a Noster app today, his point to me was the models they're using on the back end, I don't know what it is. I assume it's Claude, but who knows? Maybe it's public, maybe it's not. I don't know. But his point was those base models are trained on the past internet, right? That's how LLMs work. Next token prediction. And his point was there were not enough examples in the old training set of Noster code for sure. Well, certainly something like Cashew code. Noster maybe, depending on those the last models, like the big last training rounds got done, is on the edge. Maybe there was enough Noster. There's certainly enough Bitcoin data. So that's good. Maybe enough Lightning. But his point was, you know, in the future, what starts as a very tiny edge can quickly become huge. And so we were talking in the context of, you know, Pablo's like, oh, Rust in this and Rust in that. And he was like, no, Python's one. And the point was, because there was so much more Python, that in the future, as new models get trained primarily on synthetic data, that synthetic data, it's going to basically take existing edges, power feedback loops, so that like, oh, there's 10% more Python, that quickly becomes 10,000% more in GPT-5, which is trained off the old data. To me, this was a bit of an eye-opener where it's like, shit, there will always be ways to feed in context for things like Lightning or Noster payments, some of the stuff Pablo is thinking about, but defaults matter. I think if I had one episode title, defaults matter. And the reason, this is what we're talking about, like GitHub is not for normies, like yet. Like if I'm a normal person and I just say, build me an app and accept payments, if 98% of that just goes to, oh, Stripe, that's what we've seen every example of. Yes, you can always go and add in Bitcoin payments, build your own thing. But if the default is already one, like,
This actually doesn't worry me, because I think...
Please.
Yeah, I think if you say, hey, build me payments, and Stripe is a good solution, and it integrates, I think REPLet just announced that they have a nice Stripe integration now. So if it works, then why should there be a new solution? Like, the point of these new technologies...
Because we want to take down the banking cartels.
So if you want to, you fly roundabout way, though, not... Yeah.
But then you're front to attack. But... Let's say, what are the ramifications of that? The fees are high, you're getting gouged or whatever, then your prompt to the AI should be like,
do some machine learning,
add payments less than X percent. And then it has to find another solution. Add payments that are permissionless.
It doesn't just integrate Stripe. It says, here, we've integrated Stripe. Now put in your Stripe credentials. Go to the website and sign up for Stripe. And now you KYC, KYB, and then you find, actually, Stripe won't support me. Okay, so come up with another solution.
So I think there's two concerns there. Yes, but I think, number one, most people don't even understand what fees are. And so, like, again, going back, like, to Alex's point, he was the guy that raised this question for us on Twitter. Again, to him and to everyone deep in Bitcoin, I would say, like, you have to see what normies are doing. 2%, people don't even know the difference between 1%, 2%, 3%. Like, that's the reality. The people that are like, no, but you can run your own node for so much cheaper. It's like, dude, you're in the 0.00001% of humans. And so what I'm concerned about is defaults. And like, yes, you always could have that right to change. And to your point, if you're someone in Africa that they don't support, great. But like, it would be a shame if like the vast majority of the GDP pie defaults to Stripe, never even thinks about it, and Bitcoin just becomes a tool for the renegades. Like this.
But that's the way you become dominant, is you win at the people who are desperately in need of a solution and they're super underserved. You don't compete with the giant. You let the giant be the giant.
Right.
And you compete with the people in Africa trying to do it, people in India trying to do it, people building tarot cards.
I would have agreed with you 100% pre-AI, but what I think has changed that I think we need to be like aware of, not have our heads in the sand, is, you know, if you really are AGI pilled, do you believe in all this takeoff stuff? And I think Elon's already said Grok 5 is going to be trained off 100% synthetic data from Grok 4. What looked like maybe just like, oh, it's a lead that we could like, yeah, like Stripe could be outflanked to the left and right. If 10,000% more data gets generated, it's like Stripe, it's going to get harder and harder and harder over time, is my concern, to flank them.
And another potential dynamic, I'm listening to the latest, is it Dorcash podcast with Andre Karpathy. Really good. I love learning from him on with AI. So at one point he believes that there's too much that the model's being trained on too much data. Mm. And there's an overfitting problem. Mm. So he actually predicts that to gain more intelligence, they should be trained on less data. Mm. So they actually have to like think on their feet more. So to the degree that happens, yeah, then that would lessen that concern.
I do think it's something that I know we've talked about in the past. We've talked about ideas for future summits around digital life and open source AI and getting more of the AI and open source community working with us here at PB. But I do think it's something that I hope that's right. I don't know. I don't really have an opinion, but we should be figuring out how do we make sure that we're not bringing sticks to a, you know, nuclear weapon fight. And I will say it opened my eyes to like if takeoff happens and we're not in the takeoff, it's concerning. So, and by the way, I just want to shout out, I don't know who Maxwell's Equations is, but Tyranny of the Default by Steve Gibson. I don't know who Steve Gibson is, but, oh, is that the sci-fi?
Sci-fi, I think.
Yeah. Then I should check that out. Yeah. That's what I'm worried about. It's not that the people that are really into it, you know, the autists and the freedom fighters are going to be fine, but like, it's going to be a dark world if, I don't know, the default is strike.
Yeah. I think you can't just compete on price and ideology. You have to compete on, it's just better.
I agree, but my point is that's still thinking from like pre-model takeoff.
I think the models, if they're truly intelligent, they will find the thing that's better.
I don't think they're truly intelligent.
Yeah,
they're parrots.
Yeah, I think so, but I think there's still a lot of development happening and different, like the LLM may not be the final form of AI.
So that
seems like we should continue this conversation.
This is a big
after one. Thanksgiving.
We should go get lunch. Good James cover.
Okay.
Good chat, guys.
Good chat.
Yeah. Hey, glad we're all alive. Yeah, yeah.
All right, alive. Yes.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you 2 weeks out. Yeah.
All right. Bye bye.